Hello, and welcome to Roll for Topic, a roundtable discussion about topics related to running role-playing games. I'm Chris Salzman.
And I'm Andy Rao.
Andy, I am back. I had a little bit of a surgery that happened to me. I say it like it happened to me, like someone waylaid me.
Surgery.
This was very planned. Yeah. So I do want to say thank you to Matt Wilson, who came on and stepped in for the last episode to kind of take over. That was a really, really good discussion about running long campaigns.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Yeah. He's a good one to talk to about that.
Yeah, he is. So, I mean, I've played in most of those, most of his recent campaigns. I say recent as like in the past decade or so.
Yeah.
But he's a very good GM. I really enjoy playing with him. And yeah, his ability to like both plan out a long campaign like that and stick with it is truly admirable. Because I think we all have sort of that like, oh, I'm going to run this big campaign. And then it sort of fizzles yes. after a little bit.
Yes, yeah. We are. Yes.
Yeah. So I have a couple things. So I had a minor surgery. So I've been sort of like, I was laid up for a few weeks and now I'm sort of in the recovery phase, which basically means I can't lift anything more than 15 pounds. During recovery and also now into just sort of my normal life now, I started playing Baldur's Gate 3 finally. Which I know is a game that you really love. I think you were on Splatbook a long time ago talking with Kyle about Baldur's Gate.
I was, you know, maybe like 10 months ago, but that's a really long time ago, I guess.
Yeah.
These trying times.
It is. Yeah. So I need to go back and listen to that now that I've actually played the game a little bit. But it's really good. And I think the jokey thing that I think a lot of people say is like, oh, this is how fifth edition is supposed to actually work when they play the game. But like for real, I mean, like I've run 5e before and I'm just like learning all sorts of stuff about different systems and rules and stuff. But it's also fun too, which is good. So you've played this game through a couple of times, right?
Nope, just played it through once, and I'm on a second playthrough that I'm doing at a kind of leisurely pace. I started my second playthrough when you started it up, so.
Yes. we were texting each other, and you were just like, you know, well, if you're going to play, I got to play.
I can't have you, like, sharing updates and not be experiencing it myself, so.
Yeah. It's interesting, because, like, I'm enjoying it, but what I'm finding is talking with people that this has become sort of a forever game. Have you heard of this concept before?
I have, yes.
Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, like, so people, you like, get a game, and you're just like, well, I'm just going to play this. Like, this will just be sort of the game that I play my whole life, sort of in the background.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, Skyrim's one, like, Stardew Valley's another one that people just, like, will play and then restart, kind of come up with their own goals and stuff.
It is really interesting, though, because, you know, Baldur's Gate is not an open world, you know, like game as service type of thing. So it's interesting to me that it has this incredible replayability that people just want to keep diving back in. I mean, there's a lot of content, but you're playing through the same, you know, you got to deal with the Druid Grove every time, you know, like,
you're not skipping that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting because I think when we've talked about on this podcast about like the thought of replaying campaigns over again, right? So you finish up whatever, Storm King's Thunder, right? Like you buy some sort of published adventure from Wizards of the Coast and you play through it. And then the thought of like immediately picking that back up or even like a month later picking it back up and like same group of people, let's like just play through it again, right? I think there's something that's intriguing about that, but it's also never going to happen at your table.
Yeah, I wonder about this too. You know, I recently, while considering running Curse of Strahd, you know, there's this, it's designed, I mean, it's got some random elements in the setup and it's like, this will let you play the campaign many times. And that's like, first of all, just playing this once would be like a great achievement I'll never do. And also like, that's just interesting to me. Maybe running a campaign, the same thing a couple times, but playing in it, I don't, that's just like, that's interesting to me, but also very alien to my experience.
Yeah, there's and forgive me if we talked about this recently, but like the Curse of Strahd, like the one night Strahd game, which I've run most of before, right? I think like that's sort of tuned for, hey, play this, you know, every Halloween, right? It's sort of like a one shot that you play, and I could see that, but like, yeah, the idea of like a campaign, I don't know, just like it doesn't quite. Like, I'm interested in it, but I'm also never going to do it. But, like, at the same time, like, playing Baldur's Gate 3, there have been a few times where I've, like, stopped, and I think we were even chatting about this, and, like, I went and reloaded an old save just to try something to see what would happen. Right. And it's like that, that is a very interesting and unique thing, right? Like you're still sort of playing in the fifth edition system. You're playing in this very like tabletop role-playing game system, but it really does encourage you to be like, well, I wonder if I tried this in a different way, right? Like maybe go back or reload a save, or like the next time I go through, I'm going to be really evil this time and see how that changes stuff. Yeah. And I think it's like, I kind of wonder if it's because you are the GM is the computer. And so you can't really like, you know, you can't really make the computer like mad at you by asking stuff over and over.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Whereas like a human GM would be like, okay, really, like we're not going to go, you know, reload at the the Druid's Grove again, just so you can try to see what happens, you know, this time if you steal, you know, steal from someone.
Yeah. So my big questions for you about Baldur's Gate 3 are, first, is this making you want to run a tabletop dungeon, like a classic fantasy standard D&D, you know, role-playing game? And secondly, whether or not it's making you want to go and dust off your D&D books and run a campaign of something, have you gotten any ideas that you're going to bring into your next role-playing game, D&D or otherwise?
That's good series of questions. What it's doing for me is it's really highlighting sort of the friction that I feel with D&D in particular, of you have these really great narrative moments that you're, you know, narrative moments and story stuff. And then you enter into this like tactical combat simulator and like, it's just like the whiplash is really strong there. And I find myself playing Baldur's Gate 3, like wishing for more, role-playing options sort of to get around combat. And like, I know there's plenty of them, but like at the same time, like you're going to go fight, like you have to kind of go fight stuff here and there. It's just like, you know, cause like, I think, you know, lately I've been playing a lot more, I don't know, like Powered by the Apocalypse style games, right? Like, so you're not really doing like heavy combat, but you're still rolling dice, but you're kind of telling like narrative stories and stuff. And like, that's really sort of where my head's at right now. So then going back to like fifth edition D&D playing Baldur's Gate 3, I'm like, I enjoy this as a video game, but like, it's not making me be like, great, I can't wait to roll up a new character. You know, so like I can go play D&D now with like this extra knowledge or whatever. I don't know. Have you had the similar experience or different? Like, I guess, yeah.
I was pretty bitten by the D&D bug from playing Baldur's Gate 3.
Okay.
Partly it was, I don't know, seeing Baldur's Gate 3, it's a video game, and that at least on the difficulty level I was playing, you had to manage your spells and resources really carefully. And you had to find the value in all those spells you always like skip over in tabletop RPG, because why would you take whatever Tasha's Hideous Laughter when you could get Entangle, you know, or something. I'm making these up, you know, because Entangle is so much more versatile. Well, you know, but what if you're up against something that has really high resistance to X? Like, you need a spell that can, you know, so you find yourself in Baldur's Gate 3 using a lot of spells that basically would seem like suboptimal until you create a situation in which they're useful. And same with character abilities. And so that made me think that, you know, maybe part of the reason players always come to my D&D games with like the same 6 level 1 spells is that I don't give them obstacles or creatures or environments that ask them to explore some of the options that seem less efficient or something, but are useful in certain situations. So that's kind of a long-winded answer to your question. So I did kind of get the D&D bug from it. I was gonna, you know what you're saying, you know, the tension you described though is really real. And it made me wonder while I was playing Baldur's Gate 3, like, what is the core gameplay of Baldur's Gate 3. Is the core gameplay the fight, the tactical fights, and then the extra stuff, the break, the occasional breaks between the gameplay are all the relationships and the role-playing choices and stuff? Or is the core D&D experience that it's giving you one of choices and relationships and dialogues, and the fights are there to break up that, you know? Because there were times when I was playing Baldur's Gate 3, it was like, can I get it, there's a fight, like, let's just say I won this fight so I can move on and resolve this person's storyline or something like that. So I don't know, then that in turn makes me think about, you know, my tabletop games. When I run games, you know, what am I suggesting to my players is the heart of this game, right? Is it moving around on the battle map? Is it improv riffing with each other based on our characters? I don't know.
Yeah. It's I kind of wonder, like, again, like, I have not beaten the game, you know, I'm still sort of early into it, but I almost wonder if you could answer sort of what is the core gameplay loop of like Baldur's Gate 3 by like, what's sort of the final thing that you do in the game? That makes sense. Like, what's the thing that you have, you sort of control over your character, sort of making the decision to do? Is it going to be a tactical combat, like big boss battle at the end?
Yeah.
Or is it a final persuasion role, or whatever, or like a conversation among your party about, like, you know, the journey that you've just been on, right? It's sort of like, those are like, that's sort of like where my brain goes. And then thinking too about, so one of my favorite video games of all time is Earthbound for the Super Nintendo. Right. And it's like, it's a great game. I think it really holds up, but also it's, you know, like, it's somewhat dated too. But like the really clever thing that I think that game does at the end is, so you have this big boss battle that you fight, like, so you defeat like pure evil, essentially, right? Like this manifestation of evil. Right. And then, but after all that's done, after you've sort of saved the world, the game opens back up and you can go back to every place you've ever been in the game. And you can talk to every NPC that's in the game, and they all,
I love it when games do that. I love
different
it.
Thing to say about, like, yeah, like what just happened, and like, you know, like what's going on with themselves and stuff. And it's like, to me, like, thinking about that, it's like, it puts the emphasis back on like sort of what that story is trying to say. It's like, yes, you do become this, you know, overpowered group of preteens, right? You're going to fight, you know, fight and save the universe from evil and stuff. But like, at the same time, it's like, it's all about the relationships and like, this is why you're doing it, right? Like you're saving these people. Like you're doing this stuff. And so it's not like it has that power fantasy, but it also has the real life relationships and stuff. And like, that's the important thing that you end the game with. So I don't know, like, all that to say, it's like, yeah. So thinking about sort of your original question about like, what's the core sort of gameplay or the core loop or like what you're trying to accomplish with your game and stuff. I mean, I think that's an excellent question. It's right. Like if your session zero talks of all about like the character sheet in terms of like mechanical advantages and like spells and stuff like that, and has nothing to say about your bonds and like where you're from and like your backstory and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I think that's that'll sort of drive the sort of game that you end up having. So, and I don't think that, again, there's nothing wrong with however you want to play the game. Right. But like, it is interesting to think about, like, yeah, from the beginning to the end, sort of, yeah, what do you want to emphasize?
Yeah. Well, keep us posted as you continue playing through Baldur's Gate 3. You are in, just, you know, no spoilers here or anything, you're in Act 1, right? And you are dealing with that Druid Grove problem.
Yes.
So some of our listeners will know where he is.
I'm dealing with that. I'm dealing with a healer who may or may not be what she appears. I'm dealing with with some goblins that are up to no good, or I'm not really sure. Yeah. So there's lots of stuff, and I feel like the game keeps on kind of seeding these new like storylines as you're going on. Sometimes by like taking over completely and being like, here's something that's happening.
a thing that we can move on from Baldur's Gate 3 in a sec here, but I mean, a thing that I remember talking to Kyle about when I was on the Splatbook to talk about Baldur's Gate 3 was how it really got my GM brain thinking about putting lots of different options, lots of different routes that might lead to success in front of the players. So I don't, again, I'm going to speak carefully here because I don't want to spoil anything for you or for listeners, but you have a problem at the beginning of Baldur's Gate 3 that like that you desperately need solved. Mm-hmm. And in the first like 15 hours of playing, there you can find probably about, I don't know, 5 or 6 different routes that at least hold out the promise of solving your problem. Mm-hmm. And what happens if you, you know, it's on you to decide which ones of those you want to go down. But I guess I'm just not, you know, when I think about, you know, giving players choices, it just made me realize like sometimes I really still have a pretty limited, I have a limited idea of the choices I give them. Like should you go here? My choices that I give in my games are often sort of A, B choices. And it was refreshing in Baldur's Gate 3 to be like, there's like 6 people that say they could solve my problem. And they all seem kind of mutually exclusive from each other.
Yes.
So I don't know. I enjoyed that. And it has made me try and be a little bit more open with like when I do have choices for players. So.
Yeah, that's a super good point. Yeah, I would love to see sort of, I'm sure someone has sort of mapped out the different sort of story nodes that you can take through the game. I remember Tim Saucer, he ran a game, I think you played in that as well, where he very like explicitly sort of like mapped out the potential story with all these like nodes. Mm-hmm. Nodes and stuff. It's a really cool way to think about it. It's a very like, I don't know, it's a programmer way to think about it, right? Like it's like,
sure.
Like you're using like graph theory to sort of like, think through your story. But I mean, yeah, it is a very interesting way, like not interesting. It's compelling in that, like, I do feel like every conversation I have in Baldur's Gate 3, I don't know what sort of like the right, like air quotes, right choice is. When the dialogues are presented, I often will sometimes be like, well, you know, like I'll pick the choice that I feel like is the one that's going to satisfy everybody in my party.
Yes.
They're going to be like, yeah, because the little things are all going to pop up and say like, hey, like, you know, Shadowheart approves, like everybody approves of you all the time. Yeah. And it rarely happens. And it's always like when I pick the one that I'm like, this is not who I am. Right. And then it's like, oh, well, like, everybody sort of liked that. Like, wait, what's going on? Like, Baldur's Gate adventuring with?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the only, it's far from the only game that does this, but I think it is much better at making it unclear what the good choice is and the mm-hmm. evil choice is. And it forces you to think, I think, more like a real person, which is which of these choices, you know, gets me closer to what I need. Gets me further along my path to my goal.
Mm-hmm.
So much more interesting than like, you know, I think of like old BioWare choices, you know, do you want to burn this orphanage down or do you want to, you know, you know, give 10,000 gold pieces to the old lady, you know, like it's. So, hey, we should move on from Baldur's Gate 3 and I'll save for later. I've fallen back into Diablo. So, I'll report back later if I manage to drag myself back out of that pit. But
talk about the range of games that call themselves RPGs.
Yes. Like, oh my goodness. This. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I believe I had a question for you about Baldur's Gate 3 before I started, which was like, am I going to have to cycle my equipment as much as I do in Diablo?
And was I accurate? I think I told you no.
You said no very little, which is nice. Like I love Diablo, but it is someone a long time ago called it Princess Dress Me Up. Yes. And that has just really stuck with me because that's basically what it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is stressful. Like there's times when I'm playing where can I just put pause on getting anything?
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired of comparing two items that have like 7 different bonuses and like I have to weigh which one. Yeah, I don't know. It's
this stressful. One's got plus 15% to gold find and this one has, you know, plus 10% to
Well, speaking of which,
yes, speaking of gold, actually, so this is a topic that I wanted to talk with you about. So again, from Baldur's Gate 3, I'm thinking about like equipment and all that sort of stuff. Equipment and encumbrance is a thing in there, but also gold as well is a kind of like a big part of the game. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that actually led me to do like I guess I would call it research, if you will. Whoa, research. Whoa. I pulled.
Chris, that's against the rules of this
podcast. I know. Yeah, I know we're not allowed to do. Yeah, so I'm comparing and contrasting. So listeners cannot see this, but I'm holding up. I have two copies of the Player's Handbook. One is the AD&D one, and one is the brand new 1D&D Player's Handbook, as well.
I heard someone calling it edition 5.24. As like, no, we can't be doing.
No,
this,
we can't. We can't get down to 2.4. It's 5.5. That's fine. We can talk about that. But the thing that I got really interested in was like your starting gold, just like how gold is handled. Right. Cause okay. So again, like thinking about like fifth edition, right? Like there's gold pieces and silver pieces and all that sort of stuff. It's not really a system that I've interacted with a whole ton in the games that I've run, other than to maybe add some flavor by having like the Electrum pieces, right? Pop up here and there. Like these are like the wizard gold, wizard gold equivalent. Right. Like, you know, so that's sort of fun to play with. But like, if I'm thinking about other, like sort of, I don't know, lighter on the mechanical crunchiness games that I played, like resources like that almost never come up. Right. Like the thought of like grafting on, I don't know, like if you're playing Kids on Bikes or, you know, some sort of Powered by the Apocalypse game, and you're like, oh, and also there's this really complicated like monetary system that has you know, that has like, you know, different conversion tables and stuff like that. It's just like, you're just not going to do that. But it's also like a pretty important part about like, I don't know, societies, civilizations, and things like that too. Yeah. So anyway, it got me thinking. So I'm not going to like read tables, but I do find it interesting that like the monetary system in like the AD&D Player's Handbook is like basically like two or three paragraphs long. Like you have your starting money, right? So like, you know, clerics, I guess fighters can have the most gold to start with. Monks have the least amount of gold, that sort of stuff. And then in 5.5, 1D&D, whatever it's officially called. it's pretty much the same exact setup, right? But like everybody has sort of like different starting equipment and starting options. So like you can either choose like, hey, just give me a bunch of gold, or you can choose like, here's my sort of my starting loadout.
Yeah.
Loadout of what I have, right? You know, choose A, B, or C, you know, do you have chainmail, a great sword, a flail, or do you just have 155 gold pieces that you can then spend how you will. So my starting question to you then is, so have you really relied on any of these gold systems before in your games? And like, how has money come into play for your games at the table?
Great question. Before I answer it, let me do a little diversion. And just to call back to our long video game intro, someone who got me thinking about the economy of like my typical D&D game a lot is there's a blogger called the CRPG Addict.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
He's playing every computer role playing game that's been published.
Yeah.
So he's
like Fool's Quest. Yeah.
He's like 10 or 15 years into this. He's played a lot of games, and he rates each of these games. And some of the ratings are, I mean, I don't remember what all the ratings are, but most of them are pretty standard ones. Like, how are the graphics? How good is the story? But he has a rating for how well is the economy implemented in this game? It's from reading his discussions of this that I realized like it does make a really big difference in like a video game. You know, it makes a really big, it's the rare game that hits the right balance of like keeping money flowing through its economy, like of not letting you just accumulate wealth until it becomes meaningless. Mm-hmm. And on the other extreme, not giving you enough money to be spending it. And I truly think this is a really, really important part of a good computer RPG.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about a lot of the annoying features in like Diablo or World of Warcraft or games that force, I think this is important enough that this not feel wrong to players, that games will use things like weapon degradation and stuff like that to force you to keep like putting money, keep money flowing through you and through the economy, you know?
Yeah.
And that's fascinating to me because, and now to circle back to your question. So in my first, you know, decade of playing games, I was mostly playing Rollmaster and Middle Earth role-playing. I very meticulously counted money, you know, gold pieces, silver pieces, mithril pieces, whatever. And, what made me lose the will as a GM to keep doing this was playing more modern games. In this case, it was like games like Top Secret and a little bit of MechWarrior. And suddenly the way that money was handled did not feel like it reflected how people actually relate to money. So Top Secret is a game of super spies, right? And it has like, you get paid money, you can spend money to buy guns and stuff like that. But in the real world, your finances don't consist of you having just like a pile of money and you spend it on only cool stuff. In the real world, yeah, the world is constantly draining money away from you. And you are hopefully constantly bringing money in through like the mm-hmm. work that you do. And it bugged me because like in the real world, if you're a James Bond super spy and you're getting paid tons of money for going on these exotic missions, so you're investing it in funds and you're, you know, accumulating interest. And
yeah,
the literalist in me at the time was like, I either have to start tracking like how characters are banking and investing their funds and what their mortgage payments are and stuff like that, or I have to just drop money as a thing that matters at all. I personally dropped money as a thing that really matters at all. I'm not saying that was the right thing to do, but yeah, so there's my very long-winded answer to your question.
Yeah, I mean, well, it becomes sort of, yeah, then you're doing bookkeeping, right? Like on your end to track all that stuff. And especially if you're playing a James Bond super spy, part of the allure of that is that they don't have to think about how much it costs to, you know, buy a sports car or, you know, that Rolex, right? And it's like, you know, even to the point where like they don't have to think about like having to sit in a room and sign a bunch of papers, right? It's just like there's just a sports car, right? Like you just have that. Yeah, you can go drive it and blow it up and then you can get another one.
James MI6 isn't making James Bond spend his own cash to buy equipment for his next mission, you know.
Yes, yeah. Like
that would be amazing actually if they are, but
yeah. I mean, Like there's a good short story for you. It's like, yeah, the spy that has to supply all of his own all of his own stuff.
Well, I will say, you know, so from a tabletop role playing thing, so where I wound up with money, and this is more or less still where I am, is I was really drawn to some money systems and games I started seeing in like the late 90s, early 2000s. Like I think D20 Modern did this, where you have like a wealth stat or a bonus and something, stuff you can buy has, you know, a tier or a level, and depending on the game, you know, if your money stat is higher than that, what's needed, you can just buy it. Or maybe you roll to see if you can buy it, but you get to add your very large wealth bonus to represent like, well, probably you can buy it, but maybe you couldn't, whatever, you couldn't liquidate the right assets in, you know, in time to buy it or something like that. So like a more abstract thing that reflects like, I guess the sort of average state of your finances rather than, So what do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think, I've played in games where like that's sort of the approach. I mean, like the one I'm playing in right now, with Matt, like, yeah, we have wealth that we're accumulating, right? But then we have to spend it to sort of decide, like, you know, are we going to live in squalor or, you know, live really nicely? And then that also affects sort of who we're able to talk with and like who's going to pay attention to us as well. So like if you are, you know, if you're living like a really ritzy life, like the, I don't know, like street urchins are going to pay it.
Yeah. I like that a lot too. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot that you can, I think, do with even just a simple system along those lines. Yeah. Like, you know, same thing. Like if you're as wealthy as some sort of king and you show up at a small town, right? Like they're naturally going to treat you very differently. They're going to try to extract as much of that wealth from you as well too. Yeah. So, I mean, like I think there's stuff that you can play with there that is not down to the, like, you know, tracking like, okay, well, I've got 50 gold pieces and 10 silver pieces and one copper. Like, how much is that bow? Okay. Well, I got to buy arrows too, right? Like that sort of stuff is just like, I don't know. I think there's probably a time and place for it, but it's almost like if you're going to do that, I'd want it to be as crunchy as sort of what you were saying, where you're tracking like interests and which assets you have and like how you sell them. And then like that becomes sort of a whole game unto itself. But like, that's right. It's like that middle ground in there between like tracking everything and tracking nothing, like is not as fun, right. I think, at the table. Yeah. Cause it sort of reminds me too much of like maybe my day-to-day life or something. But.
Yeah. And what is the purpose? You know, what is the purpose of wealth, right? In early D&D, where, I don't know if you noticed, but in early D&D, gold pieces equal experience points. Mm-hmm. So, what is the, in early games, wealth was part of like a game balance mechanic, I think, right? The monk starts with like relative little, the, you know, and I think there were some classes like the paladin that's required to like tithe portions of what they own, you know, used as ways, I think, to balance around the margins of the character system. But to me, you know, if you're reading a story or a movie, rarely is can I afford to buy the thing that lets the story continue on? Like, rarely is that. I mean, there are movies based around characters wanting to buy something that they can't afford, but those aren't really movies about finances. You know, those are movies. I guess what I'm trying to say is a character's relationship to their wealth and possessions is more interesting to me than, do they have enough to get the +2 sword instead of just the +1 sword? So
yeah,
like next time I play D&D, I don't know how I'm going to do it. I don't care. I don't have the interest in like seeing what you're spending this all on exactly, but like, what does it mean to you that you're wealthy? Do you always have the best brand? You know, what impression do you make? What values of yours are reflected by, like, you know, is money, due to your background, is money something you really cling to, or is it something you spend freely? And what does that mean about you? Like, those to me set up interesting ways that characters can relate to each other and to the story. Mm-hmm. More interesting to me than like, well, we finally killed enough goblins to get like, to buy that $500 wand of magic missile, right?
Yeah. There's a couple thoughts I have in there. Like one is you could really play with the, I don't know, like the wealth within your party a little bit too. Like, I think this is probably somewhat rare in real life, but I think in games this happens more, where you might have someone of means hanging out with people like who don't have anything, right? Like, there's sort of like this wide range of stuff. But I mean, you could even do some stuff mechanically with that, where it's like, you know, okay, so the person with means like is only going to want to stay at nice hotels or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you are automatically going to be spending more money than you want to every time you go in. Like, so you could just tack on like an extra 50%, to whatever your calculations are, something like that. And then, I mean, you could also play with that too, where it's like, well, if you can't afford that or you can't stay there, like maybe you do that long rest and that character doesn't get all of their hit points back or something like that, right? Because they're just 100% not used to this.
or maybe the wealth character is constantly paying for everything and creating like that mixture of resentment and gratitude that happens in real life when this happens, right?
Yeah. yeah, I think there's a lot you could do with that. I think you'd have to have, I think, like all things, I think you'd have to have a good amount of consent at the table. Cause I think, yeah. Right. Like, I mean, if you want to make people uncomfortable, it's like, what you talk about, like money, sex, or politics with them. Right. It's like, yeah, probably in that order. Right. So it's like, yeah, they think there's some boundaries and lines and veils and stuff that you might want to have around that too. But yeah, there's a lot there. But then, yeah. So the other point that I was wondering, like, you just mentioned right at the end, like, okay, we've killed 500 goblins. So now we can get 500 gold pieces to buy the wand or something. It's like, I mean, like if you think about like what that would do to the goblin population to have 10% of them wiped out for you to convert that into buying a wand, like that wand is going to become like the thing that they care about to take away from you. Right. Like they not only want to kill you, you know, for doing all this damage to their, you know, to their people, but they're also going to want to take that wand and either make it into some sort of like thing that they revere or a thing that they, you know, ritually break, you know, or use against you or whatever. Right. Like that's like, that can kind of like become a representation. So you have go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, yeah. Being someone who's known to have it, like every goblin in the county wants you dead.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, well, I mean, for me, it was just like, I want to do the 500 gold pieces or whatever. Yeah, so I think you have that. But then there's also like, and I think, I think there's also like a question of like, sort of like instability, like economic instability that you could bring to a town. Like, I know I've seen like webcomics and stuff like address this too a little bit. But I mean, the thought of like rolling up to a town and being like, I have 200 broken goblin bows that I need to sell, to someone. It's like, no one wants those. Like, right. Like the book says that they're worth like 5 gold pieces each or whatever. But like, you know, like in real life, like you would not be able to unload those for 5 gold pieces each. Right. So like, it almost like, I mean, to me, it sort of, it begs the question of like, you should be questioning like how the trade would actually happen in real life. Right. Yeah. If you're like, here's all my broken, it's like, well, thank you. I will use that as kindling, but I'm not giving you any money for those. Or just like, or like, I literally cannot buy them from you. Cause like, I've already got 10 of them up on the wall. Like no one's buying them. Right. Like it's like some of those questions I think are more interesting to ask them. Like, where in the book does it have the list of equipment? Right. It's like, if you're getting to the point where it's like, okay, we're going shopping, let's get the list of equipment. You tell me like, and let's role play out like how you buy this. If you're not going to do something more clever with it than like reading out how much stuff costs and like marking it down on there, like just skip it. Right. Or just do it outside of,
just write it down on your character sheet. No one cares. Right.
Yeah. Like no one cares. Like you're not advancing anything narratively. Like, yeah, like you do the math yourself. I don't even want to see it.
Yeah.
Okay. So I've got one other thing that I wanted to bring up. Do you have anything else
before
that you
wanted
to? Yeah.
Before you do, can I interject real quick? When you said that no one would ever want to buy, you know, 200 broken goblin bows, I immediately thought of a picture I saw online of someone selling a giant crate full of broken bus, like CRTs that were like mounted on buses.
Yes,
and like,
yeah,
there's,
oh my goodness.
Someone probably saw that and was like, I've got to own a box of like 15 like CRTs, you know, like proprietary CRTs from bus system. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, okay. So the internet does collapse some of those things.
And that's the quirks of the global internet economy, but yes.
You've fully taken me off on this tangent. Andy, I'm going to guess, would you agree that there's probably like a community out there of people who like rebuild buses to be like period accurate to whatever, like 1980. Oh,
I've whatever. Never so, thought of this before, but I guarantee you there is.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, not even like on the road, like just in their basement. It's like you walk down to their basement. It's like, this is the Greyhound, whatever. Like, and I finally found the box of CRTs that I can hook up and like, come over for movie night. Everybody gets their own row.
And we'll watch it on this 320 pixel wide CRT.
Yes, so. And it's gonna be exactly like, I'll pump in some like cigarette smoke too. Okay. So Andy, I want to wrap up this conversation. This has been really good. Thank you for humoring me with this. One thing, again, I'm holding up the AD&D Player's Handbook. this thing is full of really wonderful tables. So if you've never flipped through it before, or it's been a while, I mean, by all means, do that. So when I was looking for money related stuff in here, I ran across the table for the minimum fees for assassination.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So this is the rules are like, right. So if you want to assassinate someone, these are sort of like the basic, like this is your starting point for how much this is going to cost.
Yeah.
Cost you. So I'm going to do a little quiz. I'm going to flip the tables on you. You're normally the quiz master here, but,
I'm going to choke so bad. That's all right. I'm so confused right now, but go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So I will tell you sort of like the minimum and maximum, and then I'll ask you a question. So if you if you want to assassinate someone who is zeroth level, and the level of the assassin that you're hiring is level one, it's going to cost you 50 gold pieces. Okay. On the other side, if the person you want to assassinate is 16 or above, and the assassin that you're trying to hire is level 15, it's going to cost you 250,000 gold pieces.
Okay.
So your range there is 50 to 250,000 in there.
Okay.
Okay. So Andy, if you wanted to assassinate assassinate someone who is level 5 and you were going to hire an assassin who is level 5, how much would that cost?
So I'm trying to figure out if these go up in a linear way or if it, I'm going to say 4,000 gold pieces.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So you would be the sucker in this scenario.
Okay.
Gygax himself says it's only 700 gold pieces to get that done.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, he knows, I assume. So
I know.
Hit me with another one.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I'll give you one more. So let's say you want to assassinate a victim who is 10th level. And you want to hire a level 2 assassin.
Oh, man. All right. I'm going to say it's 1,200 gold pieces.
This one is only 350.
What?
So it seems like, yeah, the level of assassin, like, right. So if you want it done and you want it done right, you have to pay more no matter what.
There's a percentage chance of successful assassination. Is that right?
Yeah.
So can you go cheap on the assassin by hiring a low level one, but then it has like a lower chance of killing its target?
Yeah. There is additional rules about that I haven't got to.
Well, you don't need to.
Oh my goodness.
I love those tables in that.
There's so much in here. And again, like, we need to wrap up, but again, like just turning the page, like looking at like the character classes for like assassin, right? Like there's the assassin's thieves table, for example. So like once you like level one is a Bravo apprentice. If you become a level 10, then you're finally an expert assassin. Like level 6 is a killer, right? And then like level 15 is you're the grandfather of assassins. And I'm sure without really looking at this, I'm sure that's one of those things where it's like there can only actually be one in the world.
Yeah.
And the way did it is by killing the original. Yeah.
Some AD&D classes are exactly that. You have to replace to level up. You have to replace the next person up.
Yeah. Yeah. I think like the druid, I don't know. Yeah. It's, I don't know. Like I also looked up the assassin in the 5.5, player's handbook. And it's like a couple paragraphs and it's just basically like, you know, you get a couple of bonuses to your sneak attack. And it's like,
yeah,
I don't know. I mean, it's cool. It's probably more balanced than becoming the grandfather of assassins, but it's, I don't know. There's something that I think like the AD&D really tries to like, I don't know, tell the story of the world through even just like your level. But,
You know, you have space for three tables in this chapter. What does it mean that one of them is the assassination cost table? You know, think of all the other things that table could have been and what it tells you about, like, what is this, you know, what is this game about? What is this game world like? What are the things that people like your character do in this world? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you see that and you're flipping through this and you're like, well, I want to be an assassin. Like, you want that table to come into play.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, that, I think that that should do it for us. Yeah. So thanks again, Andy. So we have been Roll for Topic. We are part of the Roll for It Media Podcasting Network. Our sister show, The Splat Book with John Corey, is great. It's John. Okay. I guess I need to get this right. So it's John Corey now, and it's Ben and Jess. Jess are all the hosts these days. I know that they just recorded another actual play that's going to go live pretty soon. I'm super excited to listen to this one. Yeah. Ben ran his Wiccan Wander game, which I've played in before. It's just an absolutely delightful game. And then did you play in this actual play?
I did. This is the first time I played Wiccan Wander after hearing about it for, you know, a year plus. And I mean, you got to listen to the thing. Like Chris, he has a resolution mechanic. Mm-hmm. Card-based resolution mechanic that is, I have not been able to stop thinking about how cool it is since I saw it. It's really good, and I truly have not seen it, and I've not seen it in other games. So go listen to it. I promise you, you'll find it interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it is good. So I've played it as a one shot at a convention where it was like sort of the worst possible way to play the game, and it still has stuck with me. Like it's really cool. I love it. I love Ben. I love what he's doing with that game. So it's going to be, I don't know. It's good. So yeah, definitely go check him out at thesplatbook.com.
At RFDCon last year were choking up talking about that game. Like exaggeration. Yeah. Like they were choking up. Yeah,
it's good. I mean, talk about a game that is designed from the start to get the emotional impact that it's going for. So yeah, cool. All right. Well, again, that does it for us. I've been Chris Salzman.
I've been Andy Rowe.
And remember, if your player's having fun, you're a great GM.